Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow with just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. This is your regular Wednesday host, Kim Justice. If you want to know more about me, you can check out my website at inaflash.org. And the nights that I play the generic intro, it is because of my fantastic co-hosts. The one at the end of the month we haven't seen for quite a while, but this month, hopefully, we'll be looking forward to having Simon back after some colliding of both of our health challenges, I guess. And the second Wednesday of each month, I am very fortunate to have Karen Robinson as my co-host, and you can find out more about Karen, and I keep forgetting the second website. I need to go back to the first show. I was writing program notes to get the other website written down, but I'm sure that one links to the other or at least gives a clue, but hopetbi.com. That was the site she started with as a master blogger and resource person for people with brain injury, and then went on to be a life skills coach. And that's one of the things that I want to touch on a little bit tonight and a couple of the things that I have to say. But anyway, I hope before we go on, for those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice, every Wednesday night, and Karen Robinson, my co-host, the second Wednesday of each month, and I'm going to bring her on in just a minute. Some of you might have well, first of all, I want to say May, when you're keeping track of these things, and I'm not keeping track of them, last month we had Brain Injury Awareness Month. This year I noticed this month I noticed in a couple of ads two things: that it's Mental Health Awareness Month. I just saw that on a TV commercial the other night. It's also Veteran Military Appreciation Month. Month on both of those. Mental Health Awareness Month, Military Appreciation Month. So I'll start out by saying we want to thank all of our military for their sacrifice and service. And at least I'll speak for myself. I can't speak for anyone else. My appreciation that you're taking the risk and the heat on our behalf, and thank you. If you want to hear a really good show 2 weeks ago, check out the show. I think it's the featured show this month with Joe Paisano, one of many veterans who's been a guest on the show. But he's working with Resurrecting Lives, and on the shows before, we've talked about the power in art as a means of helping to heal from brain injury, from PTSD, from whatever ails you, that often art holds some keys to help a person level out and to find their peace. And that's a little bit, that show was about 2 weeks ago. So if you find that that's something you've experienced, I did. I'm one of those who never considered myself artistic. But after I had my brain injury, suddenly I realized that my definition of art was too narrow. I thought it meant you had to sit down and freehand something or, you know, do an oil painting or something like that. And I can't draw a straight line with a ruler. But down the road, you know, when I picked up the camera and started taking pictures and wound up having an exhibit at our local botanical garden and having my card sold in a couple of different venues, I realized I was an artist. And then when I wrote 2 books illustrated with my photography, both of them, again, I am an artist. And hopefully, not always, and this might be one of those nights, but with the show, and disseminating information that helps raise awareness and encourage people, that is an art as well. And so that's me. And those things really helped me from the time that I had my brain injury to discover and cultivate and have brought a lot to me in finding my peace and helping me work my way through recovery in a lot of different ways. For other people who were always artistic, they could sit down and do an oil painting or freehand some kind of a drawing. A lot of those people, like Craig, that opening that you heard is, he's a musician. One of his songs called Words from the early days is the backup. A lot of people who were artistic before became even more so. They've stretched. If they were a musician, maybe they're doing a different kind of music or trying building. He also got into gardening quite a bit. That can be an art, especially the way he did it, by seedlings. We can also have a little OCD sometimes, I say affectionately, but he built what was first a little shed and now is nearly as big as his house, a greenhouse, where he starts with seedlings and has an amazing garden. So you have the cultivation of life and nourishment, and that has really helped him. So anyway, art, if you find that that's something that resonates with you and your recovery, you might want to check out that show a couple weeks ago. And we have a page on Facebook called Disability Art Page. It was just after, a few years ago, after we were having a conversation like this one, and Craig happened to be here that night, he just on the spot formed a disability art page, not limited to people with just brain injury, with only brain injury, but anyone who has a disability. And I'm an admin on there, so please don't, solicit or make it a place for commercials. This is basically a place for people to share their evolution isn't the word that I'm looking for, but to share their experience, strength, and hope in how art, in sharing their art, but sharing their art and how it's helped them in their recovery and encouraging others to do the same. It's a support page. It's not a sales page or a spam page or a commercial page to, for $50 you can sign up for X amount of classes. Please don't make me police that. Just enjoy. And I'm not on there right now, so I can't let you in as a member if you request it, but I will look at it after the show or in the morning, and you should check that out. My husband and I were just away the first week of May. Kind of funny. He's very good at, like, he remembers the date of our first meeting, our first date. My memory isn't very good at a lot of things. So about a year before we got married, when we were looking at possible wedding dates, this would have been in 04, I saw that in 2005, there was May 5th, which would have made it 05, 05, 05, and then again with a little of the OCD, at 5 is when we got married. In County 5, by the way, we actually drove out of our county, which is County 1, to County 5 to get our marriage license, and then got married 05, 05, 05 at 5. And so the first week of May, we've made it a habit as much as we can, when circumstances have allowed, to get away and go out of town and have a change of scenery. And I've got to say that two things come out of that. The really good news is that, there were some things. It's been a really difficult 2022 was one of the harder years of my life, and going into this year, that momentum was still going. I didn't get a fresh tear off the page to 2023 because the momentum of the challenging continued. And so it was so nice to go to. It's a place we've been before frequently. We saw it, we loved it, and we keep going back. It's quiet. It's not like being in the city here, which keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Sat back out on the deck that backed into the forest and watched the deer and the antelope play below our deck, and beautiful different varieties of birds landing on the tree branches coming close to the deck, and the squirrels running and playing, and then doing the things we did. But it was a wonderful distraction, for one thing. And sometimes, whether it's physically leaving town, whether or not you can do that, or just doing maybe an activity or getting a hold of a person that you haven't seen or talked to for a long time, something that breaks, that just takes a knife and makes a cut. I think a better example would be those of you old enough to remember Well, of course, now they've started over and they think it's a new idea. But albums, vinyl, it used to be that would go around and every now and then there would be what we'd call a skip or a scratch. And so it would keep going over the same thing over and over, and you had to come up to the needle, the stylus, and just give it a little tiny tap to make it move over that and continue. And that's kind of the way I looked at the vacation, is that my life circumstances, some of the things have found challenging and difficult to deal with, you know, that have really pressed my skill set. Thank God they're still working successfully, but certainly pressed it. Excuse me. It was really nice to have a change of scenery with my husband and reframe the actual elements of life. Did not change, but my perspective changed. And being able to tune in to wonder and gratitude, it had been a minute since I had felt gratitude, because I was stuck in frustration. And so that was really a wonderful thing. And it seemed like spring was slow in coming this year. We had a couple freezes in the week before we left on vacation. So we went down there, and every day but one, I truly felt blessed. When we went last year, it rained every day that we were there. And that was before all hell broke loose in my life. Things were pretty good then. But on vacation, and we still had a great time, but it rained every single day we were down there. This time, it was sunny and 75 every day but one, and it was just cloudy on that day. Days that we traveled on either end were perfect. I was so grateful for that. You know, perfect temperature. My thermometer is broken. That was a residual from my brain injury. And so when it's too hot or too cold, I kind of start having problems, and I'm more doing things inside. But to be out in that sunny and 75 in new surroundings and be able to reframe the mood I had been in and find some enjoyment. There's nothing saying that, you know, when there's something to be sad about or something to be scared about, that you have to be locked into just that emotion. It's okay to take a break. The stress of being stuck in a negative emotion can kill you. And so it's a good thing, and it was a good reminder for me. You know, it was an anniversary. It was a date with the house/pet sitter and our castle made last year, that we were doing. It wasn't me that said, I need this, and made that cut and did what I'm telling you guys to do now, because it was just my observation of what it was like. And a reminder of the fact that I can do these things. That's a skill I wasn't picking up and using, because I had mono vision at the things that were weighing heavily and not resolving easily. Like, frankly, I'm more accustomed to be honest. So I think that covers, which, that's Mental Health Month. for me. Mental Health Month is just the awarenesses that I just gave you. The only way I'm going to be mentally healthy is to stop and slow down and take opportunities to reframe, which doesn't mean not accepting reality as reality is, and it ain't always pretty, that's for sure. There's one last thing, and then I'm going to bring Karen on. Just because it was an odd coincidence, I'll play a song when I play us out tonight, because spring doesn't last forever. That was the last thing, sorry, I was going to say about vacation, was coming home. Coming home, that late starting spring and the element of a possible freeze was gone. We came home to sunny in 75, and the highs had only been in the 60s prior to that. So it's been really beautiful here at home, and the redbud trees are blooming. The lilacs are blooming right now. The million irises that I have outside in the next few days, their buds are just so fat. They're getting ready to bloom, and the grass is really green. And the birds are singing every morning like they were down there. And there is a sense of new life and hope and renewal. And for me, color kind of relates back to art, I guess, a little bit, and mental health to me. The color and the new life and the nice temperature, because it isn't 90 degrees here yet, it's just beautiful, is that for me to remember to practice gratitude for the things that are going good in life right now. And by doing that, I don't get stuck in one of the negative emotions. I'm able to strike a better functioning balance. Now, I didn't do that, as I alluded on the posting of the show. We just got home late Sunday night. And so after everything I just told you, Monday I got up to 8,000 emails, a huge, humongous pile of laundry. We got unpacked Sunday night late after we got home, but you know, I had the mountain of laundry and weeks worth of mail and the 8,000 emails and needing to get a show booked and my mind racing so fast that I couldn't lock in on any one thing, and I should have planned that a little bit better. I'm not even going to say a mistake that I made. Some of you might have picked up on it and some of you not. We'll see if your eyes play tricks on you. And I was starting to say finally when I backed up just to say how nice it was to come home and have the weather be great here and have everything blooming. It's like home looked different. Literally, it was different than when we left. You know, nothing was blooming when we left, and we were only gone a week. But in that week that I was down rejuvenating south, where things had started blooming before they do here, by the time we got home, things had changed here, so I was able to carry some of that home with me. And, you know, for that, I'm really grateful. But I got home to a full basket, feeling rushed, and it was like I took that relaxation and reframing and almost slammed it back to the place that I was before I left, because some of those frustrating things are still here to be dealt with. And last thing I'm going to say, and then I'll bring Karen on, is that I told her just before we came on the show that one of the things that's been frustrating me since January has been a health condition, and I've been going along with just going along with it, which isn't like me, but the reason that happened is I was in shock and delayed grief about my father dying. And so when I started this medical procedure for my eyes, I just trusted and allowed myself to be muscled a little because I wasn't ready to do this. And I know that the better of a state of mind you're in, if you have a choice, before you're having surgery or procedures, the better of a state of mind you're in, the better the procedure is going to go and the better your healing is going to go. Now, I understand a lot of us don't have a choice, like with the brain injury or Karen's accident. That just happened. Nobody took temperature of what kind of mood we were in. It just happened. But when there is something, you know, you can temper it. And I told this doctor's office I really wasn't ready and I'd like to get back to him. I wasn't expecting my world to turn upside down with a once-in-a-lifetime event. Once-in-a-lifetime event, because you only have one set of parents, right? And that I would like to get back to them. And the nurse, well, I call her the closer. She does have a name, but she will forever, to me, be the closer. There's one of those in every business. She told me that I really needed to, and she said it with a friendly voice. They all do that, part of being a good closer. That in order to honor the price I had been given, quoted, that we really needed to set a date, or the price would go up because they went up at the beginning of the year. And I had put this off to deal with death. And so I wasn't myself through this process, or there's a lot of things I would have said differently. But I went along with it, you know, and fine. It's like this thing had been on the front burner, life changed, and suddenly it was not even the back burner. It wasn't even on my chart. And I told her that. But we set the date for January 24th, and I started going through this procedure that was supposed to be 2 months long. Turns out it's still not over, and I got two more things that'll take us to the end of May. That is a really long time. And without going into details, a lot of things have transpired during that where everybody there is super friendly. And they've got a spa-like office, and they bake cookies, fresh cookies that are there every day, and they have a snack bar thing, a refrigerator filled with refreshments and baskets of snacks for the people waiting for you, and everyone is really friendly. But in the course of service all these months, I've noticed that things have been minimized, trivialized, left out, misstated, didn't come out the way I was told, and so, you know, some excuses will be coming. And it turns out I got a couple complications, so the next two Fridays, not this Friday, but the two after, I'm going to have to go in, and you know, in the middle of this, all these emails and things, I stopped and made a phone call to that doctor's office because one of the things reframing and going on vacation did for me was shook me, shook my perspective a little bit. And I called the office and I said, I want to sit down with the doctor before you touch me again. I feel like we've had a real breakdown in communication, and that has caused my trust to waver, and I'm going to have to go through another two procedures, you know, that have been scary and uncomfortable through the last couple months. I'm going to have to do it again because of a complication, and nobody is sitting down and talking to me about it. I'm going on YouTube and Googling. I say this to the gal who answers the "you're a current patient" line. I said, I want to sit down and talk to the doctor. I have a number of issues I want to go over with him, and I want to sit down to do it before we go any further. And so this Friday, God, I am going to get the sit down with the doctor, but I do understand what I did was there would be a time I would go in and really raise hell and say what I thought and go back to the times, you know, like I felt muscled. You know, who the hell who has a spa office has a closer who's acting like person who's got to pressure somebody obviously under duress? You know, the man with his name on the building that I cut the check to really can decide what price he wants to charge, right? So you could have compassion for someone whose family member that just died, or that girl can defer the procedure and take it down the road to another doctor. Obviously, I wasn't in the state of mind to say that back when it counted, and I'm not going to say it this time. But something I've learned is because I know doctors are always in a hurry, and that can be intimidating, not because they're gods anymore, but because you're not going to have enough time to really say what you need to say, especially if you're like me and you know, they ask you what time it is and you tell them how the clock works. So I'm bullet pointing each of these things that I would call foul on or want further explanation for or feel like I should have been enlightened a little better, that we should have talked a little better, and that there shouldn't have been a switch off of practitioners throughout this whole process, because that robs you of a continuity of care where you're communicating with one person. Things tend to get a little muddled when there's more than one person involved. And so I did learn a long time ago that if you go after someone with the anger that you feel, and I mean, not just that not that it's wrong to say, I'm feeling angry because, or I'm feeling a lack of trust and da-da-da-da, you know, to state what you're feeling. But early in my brain injury and earlier in my life, I would have a tendency to come in both guns blazing and rip somebody, a new one, down to the ground. What I found out when I did that is I was good at it, but I never got my objective met or the communication fully expressed. And no solution, certainly, not solution-oriented, because my tone and my delivery was such that it automatically put the other party on the defensive And they would either clam up, fight or flight, right? They would either clam up or meet in like reaction. Who can be the bigger jerk off, right? Who can be the meaner one? And then the whole point gets lost and it was all for naught. So what I'm going to do is go prepared with bullet points. I'm not going to give them to him to read because some of my anger will be in those bullet points. And I'm not going to read that, but the bullet points are just going to be a reminder because, again, that time pressure thing, forgetting, you know, this is a long process. Click, click, click. I'm just going to go through each thing I would like a few sentences on, and then the last thing, the what the hell happened for me to be doing this thing that's coming up. And I might have said this before, my husband and I had a talk once about the things that you should turn over, you know, let go, not keep gnawing on. And I'm fully aware of that principle of turning things over. But I did express to him the day we had, and it wasn't about this, but the day we were having a conversation about it, because he can turn things over a lot easier than me sometimes. But at the same time, I know that that's what you have to do. It's the serenity prayer. Accept the things I cannot change. Change the things I can. And have the wisdom, huge, the wisdom to know the difference. If I can't take action and change something, I got to let it go. Let the universe, karma, God, whoever handle it, get it off my shoulders, off my plate, and move on. But there's going to be times every now and again where there's something that he would turn over where I'm going to feel like I need a last dance, a conversation for clarity with someone in order to let it go. The bottom line, you know, that something happened. Well, that this whole sequence of things happened. You know, the bottom line is it is what it is. And I'm going to have to go through a couple more procedures and they may or may not help. The reality is the reality. So on one sense, you know, why would I be even demanding a sit down to want to talk to this man? And it's because it's what I need to be able to let go and go into the future feeling a little bit better. I don't know how plugged in this guy even was. I only saw him, the guy with the name on the building that I thought was doing my whole procedure, did the first 5 minutes of it, and I never saw him again. So that's one of the things I'd like to talk about. But, you know, would I be going through this complication had he been taking care of the whole thing like I thought he was? And, you know, the reasons why I wasn't speaking up and was in a trance like a zombie going through the whole process, not to thine own self be true, not speaking up and advocating for myself because I was so tired. Just tired. And they were making me more tired. And anyway, so again, another tool toward mental health is to not go off like a cannon. If you need to take skills training like I did, do it. Because if you ever want to communicate effectively and get your point across, whether it's going to change anything or not, if you just want to communicate that you're upset and angry and now scared and your trust shaken because of da-da-da-da-da-da. State it. Don't yell it, scream it, talk about their mama. Don't do any of that stuff because your point will be lost, like pissing in the wind. Your point is lost. They're automatically on the defensive or an equal offense. And then be prepared to let it go because, you know, you've done what you can, and what you can't do is keep swimming against the tide or beating your head on a brick wall. But you can swing the bat and then be prepared to turn it over. And now a last thing, and then I'm going to, let's see, I've been talking 40 minutes, and then I will shut up, but something really sad. I started to say I was going to play a song out because the season won't last, a song by Leah West called Spring at the end of the show. And I was sadly reminded of her situation, which I'm not going to dwell on any of this, but in this place where we vacation, we have half a dozen favorite restaurants that we've been to. Two places are killer breakfast places, and all these are family-owned places. And Oscar's was the name of a place that was a super great breakfast place. And we pulled into Oscar's looking forward to having breakfast this year, and we saw a woman walking out the back door with her hands full. It looked like of picture frames or something, and she looked like she had been crying. And we got out, and my husband said something about, "You open for breakfast?" And the gal said, "We're not open anymore." And I said, "Why not? Oh, gosh, that's too bad. You guys are, we come here every year and we always look forward to coming here. The food's so great." And she said, "Because my husband died recently." Now, because this is a small place, of course, we said the appropriate thing and we left. But when I was in a shop, everybody knows what's going on. There's only a couple thousand people in this town. And I said that we had been into Oscar's, and I was really sad to hear about the situation. And the clerk said, "Well, you know what, do you know what happened?" And I said, "No, I don't." And she said it was just a tragic thing. He was 48 years old, very athletic, did all kinds of, you know, rock climbing and biking, bicycling, and all kinds of athletic endeavors. Healthy 48-year-old, and they have an 8-year-old daughter. And he had on a helmet and was riding his bike. He was biking about a month before we stopped in that parking lot. And I don't know if he slid on gravel or what caused it, but he hit a tree and obviously fell off his bike, and passerbys and, you know, people gathered around him and helped him up and wanted to call an ambulance and da-da-da-da, "Are you all right?" And he was like, "I'm fine, I'm fine. Just, I need to just shake it off. I want to just go home and relax. Don't call an ambulance." And so he didn't. And he went home and had a brain bleed and died. And what the clerk said was, and she's not on Brain Injury Radio, she said, "You would think the fact that his helmet was cracked through his helmet she said it's just too bad that he didn't go and get checked out. Perhaps his life could have been saved. I was reminded of Leah West. I used her song, a different song, for the trailer on my book when I wrote it. She was my first indie artist. I encourage you to go to YouTube, to check out leahwest.com or to check out YouTube. She's got some phenomenal videos. She was single when I met her. I remember, we're friends on Facebook. I remember when she got married and the beautiful wedding pictures, and then when their darling baby boy came into the world, and then the day that I read the post, been very athletic and a biker. And I'm not telling people not to exercise. I'm going to make 2 points and open the mic to Karen and let her talk now. But Leah's husband, their little boy, Blue French, was maybe 1 year old, and Leah's husband got in a bike accident, had a helmet, fell, had a brain bleed, and died. And of course, when I heard the story of when I saw this woman whose husband had died a week ago, and he might or might not have been saved had he gone to the hospital and they had done a CAT scan and found that bleed and done something that might have saved his life. In Leah's husband's case, it was done on the spot. Is one reason why I have never and will never, for example, NFL helmet designers have called me and wanted to be on the show talking about the safety elements of their helmets. You know, they buzz when you get a concussion. Okay, well, that's a little after the fact. But anyway, all kinds of gadgets on these helmets to make it safer. And I've stood by not letting any of these people on my show. I don't discourage anybody if they know the facts, and certainly exercise is good for you. Not saying anything except I am so sorry and my heart hurts. I had a brain bleed. My heart hurts for these two women that lost their husbands this way, or anybody who loses anyone that anyway, okay, but that way, that shocking way where, you know, they're young and just out of the blue, they're gone. And their kids will never know their father. The 8-year-old, you know, got to know her father. Leah's son will never know his father except through the memories of his mother. But there's no such thing, in my opinion, of a safer helmet. 'Cause just like in the movie Concussion, where he takes a ball and puts it in a jar of water and then wraps it in swaddling cloth over and over and then shakes it, and you can hear the ball hitting the lid and hitting the sides of the glass of the jar, no matter how wrapped in safe cloth the jar is on the outside, the brain is like that ball in liquid, like jelly, potentially banging up spiny skull pieces. And so switching to football because those are the helmet makers that have gotten a hold of me more than once wanting to come on the show and talk about the great advance in the safety of football helmets. And that day won't happen on my show. I can't stand the heartbreak of these things. I do understand the reality that these things happen and people make choices, but I don't think there's a safer helmet, and my prayers go out to those two ladies that lost their husbands. That were on my mind recently because of why I said. With that, I'm going to bring on Karen. That's all I've got to say, I think, tonight about mental health, what little things I've gleaned or that have been on my mind, you know, this week, which is, what, 2 days, 3 days, in a frenzy of activity, but a culmination of things I've learned, put on recall when they slid into the shadows for a moment. I got the opportunity to get some recall with the change of season, the change of scenery, the time alone with my husband in a quiet place, and just the opportunity to relax, reframe, and then come home to the beauty of spring, which I had been anxiously waiting for here at home before we left. So thanks. That's my opening, and I'm going to let Karen on the air now and appreciate her being here. We zigged and zagged and didn't really get a chance to coordinate, but that's what I've got to say tonight, and we'll see what Karen has to say. Thanks.
Hey, Kim.
Karen, you're on the air.
I am on the air. Here I am. Ta-da! It's good to be here tonight. And I'm really glad that you got back from your vacay in one solid piece and hopefully a little bit rejuvenated.
Yep, me too. Thanks.
You're still adjusting back to the normal way of doing things. But it seems sometimes when anybody goes on vacation or takes time out for themselves, coming back often takes twice the effort as leaving did, because then you have to readjust to all the things that were languishing when you left.
Yes, and you know all about that, your trips down to Florida and everything. It's great to get away, but man, you know, when you're just about an hour out from home, all of a sudden the honeymoon, you know, of being away that you just had is like, oh, my God. You look at the stack of mail, the stack of laundry, all the emails, and think, where do I start?
Well, and then there's something else that happens with the body, too, where, you know, it's like all of a sudden it's like the cell memory of your body suddenly remembers you're within just a few miles of your own bed. And your body's like, yes, I will get some good deep breaths now. Let me get home. But,
yep.
Kim, first of all, I want to apologize to you for your experience, for the poor customer experience you had and patient experience you had and the lack of quality care you received from that provider in office. I really do understand how upsetting and disappointing and angering this is. You know, anytime a provider does not meet their obligation of care to do no harm or does not live up to our expectations in a way that causes a negative outcome or additional discomfort or disability, it can really make a person feel completely helpless and full of angst, and it kind of tears down those foundation trust and makes it difficult to want to make yourself vulnerable to that provider again. And I just want to thank you for sharing your story and your vulnerability around expressing your thoughts and emotions and even your proposed way forward by addressing such an impactful experience.
Yeah, and I just have to say on that, thank you, is that I paid for it. It's been paid for already, so the reason why I can't leave and go elsewhere with this complication that was created is I have to see the rest of it through with them. So I don't have a choice. If I do nothing, the complication can get worse. It was out of pocket. I can't afford to pay for it again, and I don't have the stomach or the energy or whatever other adjectives you can use to go start over with somebody else. So I just need to have a meeting of the minds with this doctor and make sure that he's aware, not just of the complication, that he's going to look at the chart and see the complication and what needs to be done, and he'll treat it the way everything's been treated by everybody else. Oh, it's no big deal. It takes just, a couple minutes and you're fine in a couple days. Well, you know what? That hasn't been my experience every single week since May 24th. So I don't know if I'm terminally unique or they're minimizing, you know. I don't know, but I will know after we have a conversation. So,
did you mean March 24th?
I'm sorry, January. I started the January 24th. Yeah,
oh,
is
okay.
When I had
you
the surgery.
You said May 24th, and I was like, we're not there yet.
No. And I've been making a lot of errors lately, and I don't know if that's kind of what you said. You know, this process has been going on a really long time, and it's been upsetting, but I just haven't had the wherewithal to self-advocate, you know. And that's what's hard, and maybe you can talk a little about this. You know, it's one thing for us to say here on the show that it's really important for us to advocate for ourselves, but in the case of our brain injuries, when you're unconscious and you don't know whether you're on foot or horseback and you don't know what the hell just happened, it's really hard to advocate for yourself because, you know, you're trying to just focus on being alive and doing what you need to stay that way or to heal or whatever. You know, you don't know what questions to ask and what to do and how to self-advocate, or don't have the energy for it because the body trauma and the emotional trauma, the trauma really takes it out of you. You know, you don't know where to start. And I'm not a wallflower. I'm not shy. It's not like I'm not capable. I can look back at each one of these instances I'm going to talk to him about, and I can tell you how Kim would have handled it. But Kim was absent from the death of her dad, absent from going through this procedure like a zombie when I didn't want to do it, and I allowed myself to be muscled over price. And I gave an example of how I would have handled it had I been in my right mind. And I just wasn't able to self-advocate. And that was one of the things the time away gave me, was, you know, the ability to self-advocate now. But that's a long hump between January 24th and now to be able to get myself back, to be able to handle this and say my piece. And different people think differently. You know, my husband might just say, you know, what good does it do? Just get the problem fixed, you know, and why go over everything? Well, because that's what I need to do. You know, that's why.
Well, and sometimes, you know, being the type of person that you are and being the type of person that I am, we have similar personalities in this way, is that going over things in detail, at least for myself, makes me hope that they can correct the situation, that from happening again to somebody else. So,
yes.
You know, it's like,
yes.
Yeah, you really screwed up. You really screwed up with me. And
yes.
While, you know, I really appreciate good service, you know, I feel like I need to be a voice for those who aren't able to voice for themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the other time this came up between my husband and I had to do with the hospice. You know, there wasn't going to be anything that could be done for our situation. But I really felt, you know, sometimes you feel like there's so many cooks in the kitchen that the major players might not be aware of what's going on. And you found something so unbearably difficult that you wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. And you just wonder if they even know. First of all, if you know, shame on you. And if you don't know, you need to know and fix it.
And, you know, sometimes I get the idea in my head of surely person has no clue what's going on, because if their name's on the building or their name's on, you know, the door, then I would like to think that they really do care about their business or their practice or their patients. And surely they would want to know these details so it doesn't put their business at risk or liability. However, I've found through my own experience also, sometimes that's just not the case. Sometimes they do know, and they just don't care. Sometimes they didn't know, and they're very grateful for the patient coming forward and saying something. And, you know, I've gotten both sides of the coin, Kim. You know, when I go to, I can't even tell you the number of providers I've had in the last 9 years from this wreck, from all the rehabilitation. I, you know, everywhere from, I think I've touched every department in the hospital, you know, between things going on with my family, you know, between just, if I look at the last 20 years of my life, even before the accident, you know, having babies, my dad getting cancer, my dad dying, my mom being in the hospital, the experience I had with the hospital, just I have literally, I believe, I'm trying to think if there's one department that I have not experienced at that hospital. And I am really struggling just sitting here off the top of my head to think of one department that I have not touched or experienced either directly or indirectly. So from that perspective, I have a wealth of knowledge and experience, not just as a patient, but as a caregiver, as a parent, as a daughter, as a family member, and even as a advocate and as a volunteer on some of the hospital committees. So I've had quite a plethora of opportunity to see both sides of the fence and experience both sides of the fence. And I've had some excellent providers who are still up on a pedestal for me. And then I've had some providers who I wish didn't have their license anymore. So, and I don't understand how they still do. So it's been quite a gamut of experience. But to speak to the experience that you were just talking about not being listened to or not being taken seriously. It really just struck me and took me back. And I don't like to use the word trigger. I feel like that word is so overused in our society right now. However, I am struggling to think of a word that fits better than the word trigger, other than maybe excites my cell memory of my body to remember some medical PTSD there, perhaps. Back when I first got out of the hospital going through, oh gosh, I was in the hospital for over 3 months and after the accident, and then went to neuro rehab, and then I went home to a hospital bed, and I had developed pneumonia 3 times that summer being at home, and nobody was taking me seriously as far as the providers go, except for one. My primary care physician was absolutely amazing. She's one of those pedestal providers that I referenced earlier. And however, you know, there's politics between providers, and they don't want to step on other providers' toes. And because I was a trauma patient and I had trauma specialists, everything was deferred to the specialist that pertained to that particular injury. So anything that she wanted to do, she had that involved that particular injury, she had to contact the specialist or provider for that injury. And it was really a big headache. You know, eventually I had to involve a medical case manager, and then I ended up with 2 or 3 different medical case managers over that course of experience. But In that time frame, the first year after the accident. So the accident was January 4th, 2014. And throughout the whole summer, I was involved in outpatient, every therapy you can imagine. Physical, speech, occupational, recreational, counseling, just the whole shebang-a-bang. And the common denominator from reports given to the physiatrist that I had at that time was her performance is inconsistent. Some of her performance in physical therapy and occupational therapy is really good one day, and other days it's inconsistent, like she doesn't do as well. Some days she's giving her all, another day she's not giving anything. But from my perspective, as the patient, I was giving 110% every single day. I felt like I was absolutely giving my all and then some. I was exhausted and I was in abject pain. I wasn't getting better. I was beginning to lose function in my right arm. And I kept complaining about it. I was very vocal about it. I couldn't help but be vocal about it because I was hurting. And I was, I was just not getting better. And my primary care physician, she was the only provider that really took me seriously. And she kept, like we call it blowing up the phone when someone keeps calling or keeps texting or keeps emailing. And she would blow up the phone of this specialist, this trauma specialist, and they would keep blowing her off or not returning her calls or having the nurse call and then not follow up. And I said, listen, I'm struggling. You know, my arm is getting weaker. I already had trouble moving it. And the problem that was going on was some of the injuries, I'll just cover that a little, was that I had fractured 5 through 10 in my spine of the transverse processes, and I had shattered my right scapula, and I had broke ribs 2 through 11, the ribs on the right-hand side, in multiple places. And so I had what's called flail chest. And one of those ribs had poked a hole in my lung about the size of a quarter, and I had a hemopneumothorax, so I had a chest tube, and it was a hot mess. On top of that, I had a closed head injury. I had a fractured pelvis, a fractured right wrist, and just a bunch of other, what I would consider more minor type stuff, like contusions and lacerations and stuff that needed stitches and stuff like that. However, by the time it got to be summer, the majority of those lacerations and abrasions and bruises, all the things that you could really see, were pretty much resolved. What wasn't resolved was the pain inside my body. And what was not resolved was the broken bones of my shoulders, scapula, and ribs. Now, if they would have bothered to listen to my primary care physician and to me and did due diligence, and all they had to do was do a CT scan or order an MRI. All they had to do was x-rays, basic follow-up for fractures. Didn't happen. And here it was to August, and I met with the physiatrist, and he picked up my right arm. Well, first, oh gosh, I wasn't going to go there, but I think I am going to go there, because I'm sure this has happened to other people in some kind of a different way. And I think it's important for stories like this to be told, is that he took his thing. He was always very belittling when I would go in, very curt, short on time. He had a very poor bedside manner. I just thought it was because I thought that I was interpreting it that way because I was hurting so bad. And I had zero patience, zero tolerance. And so I just took it as a personal issue with myself. So I think that's what made me more tolerant, or even though I said I was intolerant, I think that's what made me force myself to tolerate the treatment I was getting, because I personalized it as a me issue. And I kept trying to wrap my mind around, the fact of, how am I doing this to myself? How am I causing myself to have more pain? Like, how am I not giving 100% of myself, like he's saying, when from my genuinely honest perspective, I felt like I was giving my absolute best all of the time? I genuinely do believe that our mindset can affect our healing process, and that our mindset can affect, like you were saying, how things go in a certain procedure. If you're going in with a positive attitude and you're hopeful and you know, just all the stars align, then that does increase your chances of having a better recovery. So from my perspective, I was like, okay, what am I doing to sabotage myself, to make myself worse? What psychologically, with my mental health, am I missing that is allowing me to just suffer? Because I didn't want to suffer. I felt like I was giving my best. And when I went into that appointment with him, that final appointment, he held his fingers above me, like in a kind of a pointed fashion, like you're going to pick up something off the ground. And he clicked his fingers like you would click at a dog. And he was like, come on, Karen, clicking his fingers. Come on, Karen, click, click, click. He goes, lift your arm. You know you can do it. Put forth effort. You know, and I said, and I started, I kept trying to lift my arm. And at that point, I couldn't even lift it at all by myself. I couldn't get it across my sternum from the right to the left at all. Like, it had lost a lot of function. And I was just started crying. And I told him, I said, I can't do it. I'm hurting so bad. And I said, I just can't. I'm like, I'm sitting here in my mind saying, okay, you can do it. Lift your arm. Lift your arm. Mostly because I wanted to shut him up. And
yeah,
my body just wasn't working. It just would not do it. And so he grabbed my wrist. And my husband was in there, and so was my medical case manager. And he said, told me to stop being lazy and lift my arm up. He's like, I know you can do it. Lift your arm. And I started to cry. But I was trying to choke it back because I wasn't trying to, I didn't want to give him my tears. You know, I know that sounds silly, but I was so mad at him at that point that I was like, yeah, he doesn't deserve my crying. But I hurt so much. And he picked up my arm and he lifted it. And he got it. He goes, see, you can extend it just fine, because he had it extended up above my head. And then he let go of it, like completely let go. And it fell and hit my lap. And when it fell, I heard crunching in my shoulder. And I cannot even describe to you the unsurmountable pain. And I just started weeping. And he was just like, oh, come on, it didn't hurt that bad. And I thought my husband was going to tackle this guy.
Yeah, was, I wish my arm worked well enough to bust him in the chops.
Oh, gosh, man. Yeah, I definitely had some thoughts. But I was in such miserable pain. He said, on top of all that, once I finally was able to get myself to calm down and calm the crying a little, he said, yeah, I think what your problem is you need an antidepressant. So I'm going to prescribe you Cymbalta, which will help with your pain that you think you have, and it'll also help with your depression.
Well, jerk.
I wasn't feeling depressed. Well, okay, I can't say that's even true. Of course I was depressed. My life had changed completely. I couldn't do anything that I used to be able to do. However, in that moment, it wasn't the depression that was bothering me. It was not being listened to for several months and being in so much pain and him making it worse. And then on top of it, he said, and since you're inconsistent in therapy, what I'm going to do is I'm going to cancel all of it. Because obviously you don't need it. What you need to do is you need to exercise and lose weight, and that'll take care of your pain.
Oh, God.
And I was numb. I can say I was numb. So for the next 30 days, I had gone home. All my therapies cut off. Prescribed the Cymbalta, which I did try. I will say that the Cymbalta did help with my crying, because I was crying all the time. Like, I would laugh. I had what was called pseudo-bulbar effect, and I would laugh at the wrong times. I would cry at the wrong times. Very inappropriate emotions on top of appropriate emotions. So it was a hot mess there for a long time. So I will say it did help with that part. It did not help with the pain whatsoever. And it did not help me feel better about what had happened. And so for the next 30 days, I tried to convince myself that I was creating this in my mind, that somehow something I was doing or not doing was hindering my healing. But it got to the point where I was losing more function in that arm, my hand, and I developed pneumonia again. And so my PCP had enough. And she was like, she got pretty vociferous with the trauma specialist. And I went to have an appointment with him. I believe it was in August. No. It was in September, because August was the last appointment with the physiatrist. So it was September. yeah, I believe it was September when I finally got to meet with the trauma surgeon. And he said he was so frustrated by all the phone calls he had been getting from me, from her, from my medical case manager, from my husband. He comes in there, and the first thing he says to me is, so if I let you have a CT scan and an MRI, will that shut you guys up?
Oh, my God.
And I looked right at him, and I said, yes, yes, it will. I said, but I want both of them. And I would like that as soon as possible, please. And he's like, and in the meantime, I was still in a wheelchair because I still couldn't walk without a walker completely. I was still learning to walk again. And I still, you know, I was struggling with my mobility in general. And my husband was still doing all my bathing for me and dressing me and just all that stuff. And so I was already feeling like I was at the bottom of the bucket. And I just felt like when he said, can I give you this MRI and CT scan? Will that make you guys be quiet? Will that shut you up? I felt, and that sounds silly, that you should feel hope and excitement for a minimum requirement or follow-up. But I was excited about it. Now, it took 2 weeks of fighting between the specialist and the hospital. The hospital said they did never receive a referral. The specialist said he sent the referral. And it was this back and forth tit for tat for 2 weeks. So 2 weeks doesn't sound like a long time in normal terms. But when you're broken and...
yeah.
Your pain is a 50 out of a 1 to 10 every day, 24/7, 365. That is an eternity. And
yeah.
There were some days when I wished and I asked God, listen, God, if I'm going to suffer like this and not survive, then please just take me. Because this is too much. This is too much
yeah.
to expect. And, you know, I wasn't thinking of ways to kill myself, but there were some dark moments where I wished that I would just die. You know, it was like I felt like such a burden to my family. I felt like such a burden on society. I just felt like nobody cared or listened to me outside of my family, like the providers. They didn't really care. And I was seeing so many specialists that one day ran to the next, and I had a full-time job. It was being a patient from appointment to appointment to appointment. And it was
yeah.
genuinely exhausting. And
yeah.
So he did. He ordered the MRI and the CT scan. And for those of you wondering, gee, I wonder what happened. Let me tell you, this is the coup de grace. So he comes back in when he gets the MRI and CT scan back. And he meets with my husband and myself and the case manager. And he comes in and he has a much different attitude when he comes in. And
yeah,
he says, he said, Karen, I just need to say that I've never seen this in all my years of being a surgeon. And he just went on this whole thing of how this is very rare and blah, blah, blah. To me, it just sounded like, I'm not going to give you an apology. I'm not going to admit I'm wrong. But
yeah,
this is what we need to do. And he said,
right.
your scapula is still shattered. And in fact, it's worse than when you came in. And your ribs are all still broken. And there's not even cartilage growth built up in your ribs. We call that a non-union fracture. And the only thing that's going to be able to fix it is to have your ribs plated. And you're going to have reconstructive surgery to your scapula and your shoulder. And he said, and I would consider this to be something that is emergent. And he told me there was a good or a high chance, when we talked about percentages, it was somewhere between 70 to 80% chance that I could die on the table just from all of my risk factors. You know, with the delayed healing, the delayed treatment, basically him delaying listening caused me to also develop nerve damage in my shoulder and in my neck. I developed a supraspinal nerve palsy. And I was angry. I was resentful. I was bitter. I was so pissed. But at the same time, I was freaking relieved. I was relieved because I realized in that moment that I do know my body, that I did know that there was something wrong, that I was correct. The Karen before the wreck, the Karen before the healing over the last 9 years would have tore him up from the floor up with advocating for myself. In fact, I would have just been like, screw him. I'm going to go to another provider. You know, I'll get a second opinion or a third opinion. But I wasn't in a position cognitively or physically or mentally or energy-wise to do that. I thought, in fact, with that particular surgeon, he was the only surgeon in the entire region, not just the state, but the region, who could do the type of surgery I needed to have my ribs plated. So he really was the only game in town. And so it was just, it was an experience. So I was afraid. I was afraid to get the surgery. I was afraid I was going to die. Now here, we went from one end of the spectrum to the other. On one end, I was like, okay, God, if I'm supposed to die, then take me. But then when I found out that there was something that was real and it wasn't all in my head, okay, some of it was in my head because of the brain injury, but you know what I mean? It wasn't in my head, like I wasn't making something up. I wasn't creating this pain. It was legitimate. And it was nice to have something that validated that legitimacy.
Yeah.
So he said, we have to do this surgery right away. I would consider this emergent. And my husband was like, you think?
Good for him.
But we scheduled the surgery. It was supposed to be a 4-hour surgery based on his estimate. It ended up being almost an 8-hour surgery. He never did reconstruct the scapula. In fact, he removed some of the broken pieces. And I'm not sure exactly to this day why he didn't finish it, but he didn't. He just closed it back up the way it was. But he did end up plating my ribs, ribs 5 through 10. He had marked on the notes that he didn't plate any higher than rib 5 because it would have risked a chance of morbidity or a chance of death or further complications. And I had already been under anesthesia for quite some time.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that. And that experience, that pivotal moment when I got those CT results and the MRI results, I can think of about three pivotal moments throughout my whole, probably the first 4 years of my rehabilitation. And that was probably the first one that really stands out. The second one that stands out is when I got my, and I won't go into that whole story, but I will go into the end result, was when I got my SPECT CT scan 2 years later after the accident. I finally was able to get a SPECT CT of my brain, and it showed multiple synaptic brain injuries all over the place, like bilateral temporal, occipital, frontal, the prefrontal cortex, parietal, like everywhere, like mass challenges, mass synaptic shearing. And, but when you looked at my MRI and CT scan from the ER, it was normal. There was no bleeds. How I escaped a skull fracture is absolutely astounding. I don't know how that happened. I did have brain swelling when I came in. In fact, I read in my medical notes that they were debating on whether to put me into a comatose state just to because my pain was also unmanageable, even with an epidural, and just lots of stuff like that. So when I was complaining of cognitive problems and headaches and problems with the lights being too bright and just all these things, that I was nauseous all the time. Like I was constantly throwing up. It felt like the room was spinning. The room was tilted. There was just all this stuff. And I just kept getting dismissed about it. So having that, having the results of that test was like a breath of fresh air. Because then I knew where to focus my therapy. Then I knew what kind of things I had to do to address those specific areas of the brain to help, to get help. And then the other pivotal part for me that really stands out is when I got care from a neuro-ophthalmologist or neuro-optometrist. And that's when I went through vision therapy and was diagnosed with midline shift syndrome. And, oh gosh, there was a second one, which I should know by heart, but I don't remember right now. But there was two different things that are directly associated with the result of a brain injury that affects your vision and balance. And I was prescribed prism glasses and went through over a year of vision therapy. And that was absolutely life-changing, absolutely life-changing. Mm. And it reduced my headaches by more than 50%. It increased my balance because I was, at that point, I was using a walker and sometimes a cane. And I was running into doorways or the casings, door jams, things like that. And so that was just such an impactful experience. And Kim, nobody referred me to those specialists. I found those specialists. I learned about those specialists from being part of Facebook support groups for brain injury. You know, from doing research, from looking up studies. And I heard people mention things like neuro-optometrist or, you know, vision therapy. And I was like, what is that? I've been to an eye doctor. They said my vision's fine. I might need bifocals, but, you know, that's when I learned that a neuro-optometrist is completely different than a optometrist. And that's a whole other show in and of itself. But those were the pivotal things that stood out for me. And they all culminate into one of three things. From my perspective, one is lack of education by the provider, or too much ego, thinking that you can't teach them anything because they're the doctor. In fact, one of the things the surgeon said to me was, "Do you have a medical license? Did you go to medical school? Do you have a degree? Then why are you trying to teach me?" Well, how about because I've been in this body for 40 years and I know what my body feels like and I know me better than you know me. How about that? I've got 40 years of experience where you have a few months.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how about that? And the other thing is that my family had time. I had time. My family had time to read articles, to look up things and to do this stuff. And I will say the final pivotal piece for me that really stands out is when I was referred, surprisingly, by this same surgeon to a different surgeon in Minnesota. Now, I live in Michigan, so that's quite a jaunt.
Mm-hmm.
And the surgeon in Minnesota was a orthopedic trauma surgeon, and I'll share his name, is Dr. Peter Cole from Regents Hospital and in St. Paul. And Dr. Cole saved my arm. He's one of those doctors I referenced earlier that's on a pedestal for me, even still, because he was able to see me more than a year. Keep in mind, I was still shattered for that whole year with no relief. And I was inconsistent because some days I was able to take pain meds before my physical therapy, and some days I couldn't. And so some days I could put up with more pain and some days I couldn't. So of course I was inconsistent. But he said to me, Karen, when we first met on the phone, he said, Karen, I cannot guarantee that I can get 100% of your mobility back. And I cannot guarantee that I can get you 100% pain-free. He said, but what I can guarantee is that I know what I'm doing, I'm good at my job, and that I can get you to at least 50% more mobility and 50% or more pain-free. And to me, I just started crying. I said, so you're going to help me? You believe me? He said, yes, I believe you. I'm looking at all your stuff. Because we had sent him my whole medical record, all the MRIs, CT scan, the whole shebang-a-bang. And I was I had to go through 2 reconstructive surgeries over the course of 10 days. And immediately, even after when I was waking up in recovery, I could feel the difference. Like there's a difference between surgery pain and injury pain. And you can tell that you've been cut. You can feel the inflammation. There's that feeling. But when something has been repaired and you feel whole, that is a totally different type of pain. It's a different feeling. And I had to follow a very strict regimen, which I followed religiously to the letter, because, you know, I didn't want to mess the surgery up. And then when it was time for me to be able to lift my arm at home, I had a home nurse coming out and home therapist coming out at that point to help with that. And when I lifted my arm, one of the things he did warn me about was that sometimes when you go so long without treatment, that when he puts me back into place, that it can cause weakness with the other bones because they've been out of kilter for so long. Well, that's exactly what had happened because when he fixed me, my acromion, which is like right up by your clavicle or your shoulder blade, and when I went to lift my arm, it sounded like someone broke a thick twig over their knee and my acromion broke or fractured right there. So then it became, we were going to try and let it heal conservatively just by staying in the sling, but that wouldn't heal either. And so it was like 3 or 4, he kept checking it. We had to go to Minnesota like 4 months in a row, 5 months in a row, something like that. And then the first 2 surgeries were in January. And then that final surgery to plate the acromion was in May of that year. And so within the course of 5 months, I had 3 reconstructive surgeries. But those reconstructive surgeries saved my arm.
God.
And to this day, I still have the nerve palsy that he said he can't predict nerve healing. Nerve healing could take months. It could take weeks, days, months, or even years, or it may not resolve at all. Nerves can regenerate to some degree. They can heal, but it just depends on how much damage was done to it. So I still do have some of the nerve damage and nerve palsy that it affects me, and I can still feel a glitch. Sometimes that will make me drop things every now and again. If I raise my arm in a certain way, I can raise my arm. I can move my arm.
Yeah.
I can hug my children. I can wash myself. I can take care of I can get dressed by myself. All these things that I wasn't able to do before meeting him, I could do after he fixed me. So there's that stark difference. And it made me angry because with the first providers, because think of how much shortened my recovery could have been if they hadn't waited over a year to get me help. You know, it was
and
like
the way that he talked to you.
Oh,
it was
awful. So the accident was in 2014, and the first surgery with Dr. Cole didn't happen until 2016. So January of 2016. So
God, that
just
is
about
just crazy.
Craziness.
It is, well, I mean, that's kind of what I'd like to say as I sat there and listened to that, you know, on Friday, and like you'd probably like to ask those doctors, how would you like it if it was your kid or your wife? I mean, really, I can't believe the way that they talk to you. And the stuff about the medical license, it's like, and he said he had one, but he certainly didn't behave like it, you know. Certainly didn't behave like top of the class kind of material. So I don't know. That's just crazy.
Well, you know,
and like I said, that's the way I'd like to pose it to him is, excuse me, is just, you know, how would you like it if it was your wife or your kid? Would you tolerate them being treated like this?
Well, you know, we had similar conversations because I kind of did go off vocally at that point once I found out what the results were. I will say this. The surgery he did with me, I realized was very difficult. It was a difficult surgery for lots of reasons. So the man was a genius, and going back to the previous surgeon, the first trauma surgeon, he was a genius at his craft with plating of my ribs. I am grateful for that. I'm grateful for that because after he did that, I was able to breathe. And you know, and take a deep breath without feeling like I was being cut in half or shredded apart. You know, and I'm grateful for that. I don't know what happened with the scapula part. I probably never will. You know, I just, with that first surgeon. But the fact that it was able to be fixed by Dr. Cole and the fact that the end result gave me more than he even expected. I mean, he even told me during my last visit with him, the last follow-up, we had gone to Minnesota probably about 10 times total within a two-year time frame. And he had he said, Karen, you've done better than I even expected you would do with your recovery. Because guess what? I was consistent. Consistent. Imagine that. Consistent and committed. It's amazing what you can do when you actually have your pain managed, when your injuries are given attention. But then it made me also appreciate It made me look at myself differently, and it made me appreciate myself. Because if I think about, wow, can you, on the days they said that I did really well in my, you know, doing my PT and OT and stuff before the surgeries, they were literally making my fractures worse by moving my arm and moving my shoulder. And yet, besides that, I was putting forth effort to push forward, to try and put forth all that effort on top of being broken. I don't know. It just made me feel really good about myself that I really was giving my, to be able to do all that on top of all that, on top of all of that injury, on top of all of that pain and impossible, to me, that's still miraculous. That's still a success for recovery on my part, and I believe speaks to my commitment and, let's use the word, consistency. So anyway, so when you were talking about, to go back to your story, when you were talking about how they messed up and how now you have to go in for another procedure because of something they did improperly, I feel for you. I know they're what happens.
They're not going to say that, though. They're not going to admit to that. I already know.
Well,
but what's interesting, yeah, they're going to come up with something. I don't know what, but, you know, when I couldn't believe it and did, there are YouTubes. God, I had no idea. I used to just listen to YouTube for music, and then when I started writing that book, I was doing a lot of research on YouTube because there was a lot of material on there. And then when this procedure started, by God, there's a YouTube on everything. Now, I'm not saying that's gospel any more than the news, but if you watch 20 of them, you know, you can see the similarities in them. And if they're doctors doing them that do the procedure, you know, then you are kind of wondering, A, why this conversation wasn't had in person with me, the patient, you know, why we weren't discussing these things that are so common to these YouTube videos, and why was I looking it up? Which is not to say that, you know, you don't do your homework, but I mean, you really, I won't even tell you how much money this guy got, and that's not even the point. But it,
sorry about that.
Hello? Oh, I thought I might have done that.
I forgot to mute my phone.
Oh, well. And I moved at the same time that you did that, and I was afraid that I hit the button, but I didn't recognize the song. I was like, wait a minute. I don't have that song in my playlist. Anyway, yeah, you know, we do our due diligence, but now I know some of the questions to ask. But what it did say about this complication is that 15% of people have it 2 to 5 years after the surgery, not 10 days. Nowhere on there in what I Googled and read from reputable sources, you know, Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, wherever, nothing in the YouTube or that I read talked about it happening so quickly, if it was going to. And then, you know, I told the guy in the beginning before I did this procedure, I told him about my brain injury. I even went a step further. I brought him, this was really just kind of a gift thing. It wasn't, I didn't have an expectation. But, you know, I had cleaned out my car when I switched cars, and I had some books in there. My book that's on Amazon and that, you know, different places, I had some books. And I took him a copy of my book when I went in. And Chapter 3 describes my brain surgery. Now, I wasn't thinking at the time how the optic nerve, and this is, I'm interested in your, the eye doctor, your neuro-ophthalmologist you were talking about, because I wasn't thinking, I should just put a big fat period there, I wasn't thinking, but, you know, what impact shining a laser into my eyes over and over could have on my brain or my optic nerve or affect it. Like, I could maybe ask, not really, but I'm saying, I could ask a person how many of a surgery they've done before, and they could tell me how many. But then if you thin the herd and you say, how many people that have a clip holding their brain together that have had an open craniotomy have you done this procedure on? And I'll bet that there aren't any or many. And so one thing I don't want to do, but I think it's ironic because the chat room said it and I had a time of it when you were talking, and I was just wondering from your experience, you shared your experience, but it appeared several people concurred here, that why do you suppose it is, oh, and we, God, we only have 7 minutes left, so quickly, why do you suppose it is that we have a tendency to blame ourselves so much? Because I know a lot of people, besides just those of us here tonight in the chat and you and me talking, but people out there listening who that probably really resonated when you went through what you were saying about the tendency to blame, have blame and shame on ourselves and not, well, I'll put a big fat period after that. I mean, because I do think that all of us try as hard as we can with the cards that we're dealt, and it is very confusing and very hard, and we didn't get a handbook on it. And if they're not sitting down and explaining things to us, that's one of the things I was hearing about your stuff too, is, you know, they were going the through the procedures of doing their job like a car going through the body shop. They don't sit down and discuss it with the car. They just do what they're doing, you know, to put a fender back on, bang out the dents, you know, put new glass in, and they're not discussing the details, you know, with somebody. But I don't know. I just, it's a really hard time to be hard on ourselves. It occurred to me. And Ron, when he said the same thing, when you were talking about your example of not at that particular time unloading on a couple of those doctors that really needed it, looking for what you were doing wrong. And it appears that we all have gone through some period of that with our brain injuries and other things too, I guess. I'm not sure why we do that, look for something to be our fault. And maybe it's a matter of control a little bit, because we can't control what the doctor does, but like you said, and I was the same way. Mm-hmm. Those could have been the exact words out of my mouth with this eye thing. I did everything over, above, and beyond what I was told because I didn't want to screw up, risk screwing up on my end.
The end result.
You know what?
Right, right.
The end result, yeah.
And then you're put in a position where, you know, at this point, it's like, oh, you know, some of my family's like, well, can't you let it go? It was 9 years ago. Can't you let it go? It's not that I am holding on to it. It's that I can use it to either let me be bitter or better. And I use it to let me be better by sharing the story with others, by helping others find their own voice, by teaching others how to advocate for themselves. So you can learn to trust your body and trust what your body's telling you. Learn to speak up for yourself and to keep speaking until you're heard. You know, I think that's the biggest thing. And I think that's what really affected me with the blog too, and why I felt so compelled to continue it, you know, even still, you know, this many years later, is that there's so much that changes with brain injury science, brain injury discovery and treatments around polytrauma, that it's really important to, you know, have that knowledge and not just awareness. Not just bringing awareness, but bringing advocacy for proper treatment. And I just want to say one more thing real quick, and I know we're going to be ending the show here in about 3 minutes. But did you know, and I'll leave you with this question, Kim, did you know that unless you hit your eyes, the TBI would not cause a cataract? However, if you were put on high doses of steroid medication after your injury, commonly done to help prevent brain swelling and inflammation, even in those who have had strokes, that steroid can cause earlier cataract formation, which can also affect your vision. So just a final question on that one.
Well, no, that's interesting because all my mom's friends were saying, isn't she young to be having cataract issues? I thought so too, you know. And I do want to say, because there's 90 seconds and then we can go, because I do want to say one more thing that'll be on the show, but they're in my ear saying 90 seconds. So for those of you that where the show is going to cut off, you can dial in real quick, 424-243-9540. And hear the last couple comments, 424-243-9540. Or the show will be played in its entirety in the archive. And you can take the slider and slide all the way to the end. You don't have to listen to the whole show again if you were here for part of it. That's probably a good tip to know, too. But I just want to say good night, God bless, happy Mother's Day to everyone out there that it applies to, and to my co-host Karen, and that I appreciate you all listening. So I'm going to take us up to where the show ends and then just make one more comment that I can't make in 10 seconds, I don't think, but it is relevant to something you said. 10 seconds. Let's count them down ourselves so I don't get cut in the middle of a sentence. And I didn't talk long enough in thanking everybody so much. Okay, the clock went down. All I want to say now before we close out, then if there's anything else you want to say, certainly go ahead. But about the doctors saying, you know, the patients are a teaching tool too. You know, I think of the people that donate their bodies to science and how much medical students learn from the people who have chosen to donate their body to science. It's the same thing when we patients are living. As far as those comments about, do you have a medical degree? Yes, I would like to think that someone with a medical degree has a better level of knowledge to work with us to find solutions, but to work with us, not at us, to find solutions, because we are still a resource in their continuing education, which every doctor has to take continuing education to keep their license. And right in front of them every day, cut down from an hour to a half hour to now 15 minutes if you can get it all in that quick, whatever amount of time they're spending with whatever amount of patients every day, those are all live teaching tools. So to think that you're beyond being able to learn your craft from your patients is very short-sighted and ignorant, in my opinion, because you can read about something, but if you haven't experienced it, and I doubt that the person that wrote the paragraph or two on TBI, I think there's probably more now that there's more known about it. But when I first started this show 13 years ago, they had about two paragraphs on TBI in their medical book. Now, think of that in terms of, you know, do you have your medical degree? Well, yeah, you have it, and you had two chapters on TBI, you know, and somebody else, an eye surgeon, a foot doctor, maybe something closer to the brain, you know, somebody is fixing, yeah, the neck, the shoulder, you know, have those people had experience with brain injury? It's kind of like when they prescribe a drug to a person, you know, that drug has only been tested by itself. Every combination of drug that's probably being taken along with that drug when it's prescribed has never the effects of drug A with drug B and drug C. That's never been tested. That test is going on in those people right now. And so I guess I would like to think that, you know, shows like these, I've encouraged people before to take the link to some of the shows in the past that have been on and said, send this to your doctor, see if they listen to it. It doesn't hurt to try. They might not, but they might. And if they do, you know, and a number of times I've had on doctors who have had TBIs, and they will be the first to tell you they look at things completely different now that they've lived it, lived through it, than they did before based on their medical degree and what they read in a book. Totally different ball game. So, you know, again, I guess if you're in the medical profession and you really care, then part of the solution is looking, not being dismissive, but looking at us right in front of you as a furthering of your education, making you a better doctor. And to not realize that, you know, you're really not doing your continuing education very well, or taking advantage of an opportunity to help others. And I'm going to assume that's what you went into the business for in the first place. Especially these days, you know, the more managed care we get, the less you can just say, like when we were young and everybody wanted their daughter to marry a doctor, you know, because they made so much money. Not quite so much anymore, you know, and so there's less doing it. But anyway, it just struck me when you said, repeated what the doctor said, that, hey, wait a minute, larger than life, you know. Here's some continuing education sitting right in front of you. So,
well,
anyway.
Could I add a couple things, Kim?
Yeah, you're free to talk on now. Yep.
Okay. So the first thing I wanted to say was, I know it sounds like we're kind of being hardcore against some of the providers. I do want to say, though, that there are some excellent providers out there. I did want to express that. And I did want to say that not all providers look away. There are some, there are the majority, I would say the majority of providers really care and really want the best for their patients. And the providers that you can tell really care about their patients are the ones that listen to their patients and are willing to look at what their patients are showing them. You know, the PCP I have now, I really am very grateful for. I'll bring him articles, you know, I'll take in articles and say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And he'll have a genuine conversation with me about it. He'll say, you know what? I didn't even know that. There's no way that I can keep up on all the science and developments, you know, that are happening every day. So it's nice when my patients are able to bring things to me and show me articles or show me things that have been discovered that I can then learn about. To me, that is a good provider. That's someone
who is
still willing to learn. Someone that is not caught up in their ego with you being able to teach them something. Something that they may not even have time. I mean, we don't even get a full 45 minutes for an appointment. And how are they supposed to give, to play devil's advocate, how are they supposed to give proper, good patient care when the corporation they're working for and the insurance commission and all these other places are forcing them down to 15 or 20 minute appointments and herding us through like cattle? It kind of makes it difficult for them to have that personability or that extra care or the attentive listening. How he finds the time to do that, I don't know, but I'm grateful for it. And
well,
I think it's important to acknowledge.
Yes. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just what you
said. No, that's okay.
What you said. Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize.
You're okay. Go ahead.
That was super honest of that doctor to say, and you didn't. I don't think we were. I was doctor bashing with something I'm going through right now, a provider. But you put a doctor on a pedestal, so I don't think, you know, that our intention was that at all. But what you just said is that person was honest, you know, and it's what I've told you before about having a co-host. It's so helpful to have someone bring you the information that you don't have time to sit down and search for all the time because of the other obligations. So I really appreciate the honesty out of that doctor you were just talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes me trust him. It would make me trust him more.
Yes.
And it would make me less wary and less apprehensive if he were to suggest something to me that I may not be completely comfortable with, because I know that he's going to do his due diligence to check it out. And
yes,
you know, and he'll even, he will even sometimes give me a handout or tell me where I can look to find whatever he's talking about with me. So I appreciate that common dialogue back and forth where he's not belittling to me. And I find that it's very rare to find that in a provider. But when you find a provider like that, you really want to hold on to them. I just wish all the providers
absolutely
were like that. I did want to add
I
the
do
sec-
too.
Go ahead. The second thing
no,
I really want
ahead
to add real quick is that you had mentioned earlier about donating the brain to science. And anyone anyone can donate their brain to science. However, there's a real need and there's a shortage for women donating their brains to science. Most of the research that's been done, there are limits to the research that can be done on the brain of a living person. And so that's why it's essential to have people who want to be a part of research pledge to donate their brains. And post-mortem brain research is really important to be able to help develop not just better diagnoses, but evidence-based treatment and prevention strategies for a brain injury. And one site that I want to refer women to is called pinkconcussions.com. And you'll find information on there about the difference between men and women and the different brain injuries, the differences between brain injuries, between the two genders, and also why the donation of women's brains are so necessary and needed. Donation of women's brains are needed because in the past, the focus of all the TBI research has been primarily, surprising, based on men. And without recruitment of women to pledge their brains. So that's resulted in very little post-mortem research on the brains of females. And while there is post-mortem brain tissue available for the study of brain injury in men, there is almost none for women. And so at pinkconcussions.com, they have a link there of a place where you can pledge a pink brain pledge is what it's called. And for those of you that are organ donors or interested in becoming organ donors, something that I did not know that I recently learned was that if you pledge to donate your organs on your driver's license, that pledge does not cover the brain.
No.
The brain donation is a separate process entirely and requires a separate pledge and commitment in order to be able to donate your brain. And you can do both types of donations. It's not either or. So if you want to be an organ donor and have that added to your license, but you also want to donate your brain, or if you only want to donate your brain and not be an organ donor, you can do that too. So check out pinkconcussions.com, and you'll find a lot of useful information and research and press and all kinds of stuff there regarding the pink pledge, the pink brain pledge. But
yeah, they've been guests on the show before. I'm glad that you brought that up because that is really something to think about, and you're right. Most of the research has been done on brains donated by men from the NFL, you know, is where they've gotten a lot of their information in the beginning. So it's important that all kinds of people be, you know, because the more they find out with some of these brain injuries that later turn into something degenerative, you know, they really need the brains to be able to study these dynamics and know what's going on. And Boston University has a very active brain donation program for that. There's a couple other places, but yeah, Pink Concussions is a good place to go. So, well, thank you. Once again, I hope everybody got some good takeaways. We don't always plan to the letter what we're going to be talking about on the show, but I always wind up with takeaways when we're done with the show, and or things that help reinforce what I'm doing right, or things that will give me a little wave of how I could do something a little bit different. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate you, Karen. So thank you for being here tonight and everything that you bring to the show each month.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again, Kim. We make a good team.
All right. We do. We do at that. All right. Well, thank you. And just because I said that I'm going to, I am going to, and because I take spring out as soon as summer hits and I get my second wave of not as bad a seasonal affective disorder as going into winter, but before it starts getting super hot and sticky, I talked about Leah West earlier, and this is her song, Spring. Good night and God bless everyone. Take care.